is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and check this out.
It is not appropriate to invade a country and at the end of a barrel of a gun dictate what you are trying to achieve. That is not 21st century G8 major nation behavior.
Secretary of State John Kerry lecturing Russia's leader Vladimir Putin in Kiev about his apparent de facto annexation of various parts of Ukraine. Who is more 21st century? Is it Kerry or Putin's brash territorial ambitions? Perhaps Kerry's global norms and shared principles idea of international politics is what's outmoded in this century. We will speak about that with former U.S. National Security Advisor Samuel Berger. Also this hour, a tender and thrilling look back at the late astronomer Carl Sagan, who dispelled America's fears of science back in the 20th century, whose mission continues in this century with the launch of the new Cosmos series. Sagan's wife and Cosmos executive producer Anne Druyan will join us. And of polar vortexes and insect die-offs this hour, and how technology has no monopoly on innovative thinking at Toyota. But first, on the Ukraine crisis, joining us is Samuel Berger, former National Security Advisor under President Clinton. He's now the chair of the Albright-Stonebridge Group, a strategic diplomacy firm in Washington. Mr. Berger, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. It's good to be here.
Where do you think Ukraine stands right now? And are we looking at a new Warsaw Pact line in Crimea all of a sudden with troops from the West facing troops from the East?
Well, I think we're at a delicate moment. I think at this point, it's a combination of deterrence and diplomacy. We need to be clear that if he goes further, if he persists in this course, he's going to pay a price. We need to close the door, but we need at this point to keep a window open if we can engage in some discussions in which he decides to bring his troops back to base and de-escalate this. That would be the best result.
Many voices, some predictable voices and also some very responsible academic voices on Russia and Ukraine have argued that the degree of difficulty of this event in the foreign policy legacy of the Obama administration is much, much higher than anything else they've had to deal with up until now. And many have said the administration is simply not prepared for it. How do you see it?
Well, this is a very dangerous situation because we really don't know what Putin's intent is. He has a kind of Russian nationalistic, almost messianic sense. Does he have a greater ambition here? We don't know. We have to assume the worst, prepare for the worst. It obviously is, I think, the largest potential international foreign policy crisis the president has faced because of the larger stakes here, particularly if President Putin moves further into Ukraine.
Although, and not to take Putin's point, and I don't find him to be, you know, any sort of Nobel Prize-winning candidate here for peace or anything else, nevertheless, the Russians have watched NATO acquire nations in Eastern Europe on the other side of the Warsaw Pact line since the fall of the Soviet Union. Didn't at some point the West and the United States and the White House consider, and even this was an issue for President Clinton, that at some point the Russians were going to say, enough, we're done. And saying enough at Ukraine actually makes some historical sense, even as radical as this crisis seems right now. Was the administration prepared for the point at which Putin and Russia would say, enough of this, NATO and the West acquiring these territories?
Well, NATO didn't acquire Ukraine. The Ukrainian people, after Yanukovych tried to cut a deal with Russia, said, no, we don't want to be part of a Russian nexus. We want to be part of a European sphere. They went into the streets. Yanukovych sent the goons after them. Was very violent and created a national furor.
Although fact, an opportunity,
you know, as you look west, John, you know, all the basically states of Eastern and Central Europe, by and large, are doing well because they have solidified their democracy. They've privatized their economy. They're entering into the modern global economy, and Putin has to at some point understand that that's you know, that's the future, and Russia needs to be integrated into that global economy if it's going to to grow and not languish behind.
Finally, do you believe that Putin has essentially annexed Crimea right now?
That may be where he's headed. I don't know for we don't know for sure. This is a bit of a pause here. He certainly has, 15 or 16,000 Russian troops there. We'll see where he goes. I think that would be an unacceptable outcome from our perspective. Clearly, Russia has historical, cultural, religious interests in Ukraine, and particularly in Crimea. Very large, 60% of the population, Russian-speaking population, obviously large naval base there that's very important to them. All those interests have to be taken into account, but not by taking over Crimea. And I think there hopefully will be ways to still create some sort of process by which those interests can be taken into account without annexation. But we'll have to see how he plays it at this point.
Sandy Berger, former National Security Advisor under President Clinton. He's now the chair of the Albright-Stonebridge Group, a strategic diplomacy firm in Washington, D.C. Sandy, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Sandy Berger's strategic view from Northwest Washington. The view from Capitol Hill now. Todd Zwillick, takeaway Washington correspondent. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
What's the debate on Capitol Hill regarding a response to what's going on in Ukraine?
There's a surprising amount of unanimity, or at least consensus, emerging along with the White House, John, about what to do in terms of U.S. reaction. But that only goes so far. First, let's start with money. There is an emerging agreement, as John Kerry said when he went over there. Look, he had the information in his pocket, $1 billion in U.S. aid directly to the Ukraine for starters, and then some IMF loan guarantees on top of that. Now, after that, it gets complicated when you talk about sanctions and how to deliver them. Listen first to Chris Murphy. He's from Connecticut, and he's chairman of the Europe Foreign Relations Subcommittee.
I believe that Congress should authorize broad authority for President Obama to enact strong sanctions on Russia through penalties to its banks, its oil companies, and its political and economic elite. I believe the president should only be allowed to use this authority in the case that this illegal incursion into Ukraine continues, and that we should give Moscow the opportunity to reverse course or join with the international community to address their concerns about the safety of Russian citizens in Ukraine.
You know, the takeaway here, and it's very, very interesting, is that over the past 15 years, Russia has grown much closer and much more dependent upon the West in financial terms. And so when President Obama says there will be a cost, he's not just bluffing here. There are actual costs. The problem is it's going to hurt more in Europe than in the United States, which is almost energy independent right now.
And that's the difficulty for what Chris Murphy, the senator, was just talking about on the floor, and for what Sandy Berger was just talking about with you. They talk about off-ramps, John. Let's construct these sanctions in a way that tells Putin you can avoid these sanctions if you back off now. You heard Chris Murphy talking about it there. Now, you put your finger on it. The difficulty is Europe. The economic tendrils are so entangled with the West now, which is largely a good thing, that it's becoming difficult for our senators and congressmen and people in the White House to get Europe to come along. I ran into Murphy after he made that statement on the floor, John. You know where he was headed? He was headed back to his office to get on the phone with European parliamentarians, his counterparts in Germany and other countries, to say, hey, guys, you need to join us in these sanctions or we're not going to have a united front and it's going to be useless. What's the difficulty? France gets half its natural gas right from Russia. Germany, over a third of its gas. It's fine for the U.S. to say, let's hit Gazprom where they live. The Germans and the French, that would stagger their economy. So you hear the difficulty, John.
And, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine ended when they started to tamper with those Gazprom spigots there in Ukraine that serve Western Europe and the rest of Europe. So, but that's just one of the issues here. In terms of these financial sanctions, do they scare the Russians at all? Do they think the U.S. is bluffing?
Well, John McCain spoke to me about that yesterday. There's an act in the U.S. called the Magnitsky Act. What they do is they pass sanctions sometimes against individual people, in this case, individual Russians, oligarchs, to say they can't move money in the U.S., freeze their bank accounts, they can't spend money here, they don't get visas. And here's what John McCain thinks that will do to Putin. Listen.
Magnitsky scares the hell out of him. Magnitsky scares the daylights out of these oligarchs that love to raise their kids in London and spend time in Las Vegas. And that has really had an effect on the Russians.
And the tangible impact of that statement from John McCain relates to the decline in the ruble. The ruble has fallen off a cliff in this crisis. And so oligarchs trying to shelter their money from problems with the ruble under these sanctions would have nowhere to go.
And it's even more personal than that. Shelter their money, yes. How about shelter their kids? There is a giant cottage industry in London, England in particular, where Russian oligarchs have big houses. They educate their children in British boarding schools to the tune of hundreds of millions of pounds per year in sterling. That's important to the Brits, including their education sector, their banking sector, their real estate sector, which is largely Russian now. So when John McCain gets on the phone and calls up the foreign minister of the UK to say, we need Magnitsky restrictions on Russian oligarchs, they say, sorry, that's a major funding source for us. You can start to see the difficulty in the sanctions that are emerging. Look, we may get an agreement by early next week here in Washington about an aid package and sanctions. That's great. The question now is, how far does it go if the Europeans balk and there's not a united front against Putin in trying to punish him and drive him towards an off-ramp in terms of Ukraine and the Crimea, John?
And although on Britain, we should note that so far, the rhetoric out of London has been very, very strong against Putin. We'll see if that holds. Todd Zwillich, thanks so much.
You bet.
Todd Zwillich, takeaway Washington correspondent. One voice from the 20th century speaks to the 21st later this hour. Anne Druyan, the wife of the late Carl Sagan, on the influence of Sagan in the 1980 Cosmos series and her ambitions for the new Cosmos series.
The hope of the future is that the information that has been gathered by the generations of searchers who we celebrate in the Cosmos series, that it needs to belong to all of us. It needs to be widely distributed, not in a single place or a few places for the elite, for the select few. It has to belong to all of us, and that's Neil and Carl and me. That's our ethos.
Neil deGrasse Tyson hosts the new Cosmos series. Did astronomer and great 20th century evangelist for science, Dr. Carl Sagan, speak to you?
My name is Robin, and I'm calling from Grand Forks, North Dakota. My Carl Sagan legacy that he left to me is each and every night of my life, I go to the window and I look for the moon and I look for the constellations. It's just ingrained in me, and I call my children when there's a beautiful new moon, full moon every month, and I never forgot his stories he told me of wonderment of the universe.
Hello, my name is Jackson Bradley. I'm calling from Hot Springs, Arkansas. I was inspired decades ago by the series Cosmos. My son Michael actually named his son Sagan Michael after our dear departed Carl.
Makes me think of Jodie Foster staring up at the stars in that movie, Contact. Got a story? A Sagan story? Call us at 877-8MY-TAKE. Can the federal government reverse a trend which has been solidly building in America since the 1970s, the vast income inequality, which puts the United States at the top of the heap, the widest income gap between rich and poor in the industrialized world?
As a country, we've got to make a decision if we're going to protect tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans, or if we're going to make smart investments necessary to create jobs and grow our economy and expand opportunity for every American.
President Obama believes his new $3.8 trillion budget announced yesterday is a start at narrowing that gap. It offers early childhood education programs, investments in job training, and tax benefits for working and middle-class Americans to reverse the net decline in personal income for those groups over the past two decades. The Republicans predictably have a different approach, expected to be out by the end of the month, from House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, who has long claimed the federal government is making things worse on the low end of the income scale. The GOP budget will reportedly propose $800 billion worth of cuts in entitlement and anti-poverty programs. Peter Edelman is the author of So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. He joins us from the law school at Georgetown University Law Center. Peter Edelman, welcome.
Thank you, John.
So do you think a federal budget can influence something like the income gap, a trend that's been growing for decades?
I do. The federal budget is a powerful instrument. We have a long way to go. The inequality in our country has been building up for a long time. But this budget from President Obama is taking us in the right direction, both at the top and at the bottom of the inequality that we have in our country.
When you say at the top, how is it working at the top?
There are a number of tax changes. They're not as extensive as I would like, but there's some loophole changing in there. And in fact, some of it is for the purpose of financing some of the efforts that are proposed in the rest of the budget.
Isn't that a little symbolic in the sense that it simply signals that the rich won't be able to expect the kinds of tax cuts that they've enjoyed over the last decade and a half? But it doesn't necessarily address the structural issues.
It does not. The more important part of this budget is what it does at the bottom, along with the president's legislative proposals that go back to his reelection in 2012. The raising of the minimum wage, the large investment in that all-important area of 0 to 5 child development, the earned income tax credit proposal in this budget. These are all things that are tangible, that certainly don't solve the problem, but they move us in the right direction. And when we talk about inequality, John, we have to talk about the bottom as well as the top.
And let's talk about the bottom. Democrats always talk about early child education, but when those kids get into middle school, in many communities around America, they just simply fall off the cliff. And so those investments didn't necessarily play out.
Well, that's, of course, an issue at all times, and it's not just a matter of federal policy. On the other hand, this administration has invested more in elementary and secondary education than any other, and I think what Secretary Duncan and the president are doing goes in the right direction. There's $500 million in there for school turnaround grants. There's $300 million for a new race to the top on equity and opportunity. There's a long list if you look at the education part of the budget, and I think it's all very constructive. Can't do it by itself. Need people at the state and local level and civic engagement. But education K-12 and on through post-secondary, it's vital.
Although I'm wondering if this budget represents a revisit of some of your frustration when you were in the administration, in that it is incremental. The Obama administration is kind of telling people to jump on the bandwagon, but it's not a Roosevelt-style revolutionary approach. Even some of these programs that were only proposed in the second term, the president didn't have the sort of political guts to propose in the first term. Does that frustrate you at all?
Let's not derogate the president, because this is one of the worst political times for our country in terms of these kinds of things that we've ever had. The Republicans basically say no to everything. They hadn't even read the president's budget yesterday, and they pronounced it dead on arrival. Congressman Ryan and his colleagues are proposing a bunch of proposals that are completely non-starters themselves, that are completely old stuff. There's nothing new in it, and there's nothing constructive in it.
The $800 billion in cuts at the low end of entitlements and anti-poverty programs. Do you buy Ryan's argument on any level that certain anti-poverty programs provide a disincentive for people at the low end to increase their income by other means in the marketplace?
Mostly no. I don't buy it. There are always issues at the boundary between getting public benefits when you don't have a job and going out and getting a job. We have to always have to take care that we're helping people go to work. And so there are some places where there ought to be smoother transitions. But no, I mean, they're just wrong. And it's not based on fact.
And I'm not interested in derogating the president, but we need to both agree that neither of these budgets have much of a chance of going anywhere in this Congress. As someone who looks at this in the big picture, where should we be headed? I mean, if we really wanted to have an impact, and if the president had the power to do so, what would you recommend that he do?
We have to pay a lot more attention to jobs, number one. Jobs period, but then jobs that pay enough for people to be able to support their families. We've turned into a low-wage nation over the last 40 years, beginning with the loss of manufacturing jobs and globalization. So number one is, how do we get people to work? Serious policy to do that, even creating jobs to do some of the things we needed, build infrastructure and take care of kids, build housing, all of that. So jobs and income, large investments and improvements and reforms in our education system, starting when kids are born and going on through post-secondary. Those are the big things. We have to change our criminal justice system. We're locking up so many young men who just lose their chance at an opportunity in life. So the list is a lot longer even than what Congress can do over a period of years. We need a national commitment to make changes that make this a better country.
Peter Edelman is professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, author of So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. Peter, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Ever since the dawn of manufacturing and mass production, corporations have tried to design their factories to be just as efficient as they can be, designing tools and workers to collaborate in ways that produce the most products for the least money. Efficiency experts to observe and recommend have been around since Henry Ford, and they have become a real feature of the Japanese way of doing things. Here's Jamie Bonini from Toyota.
I take a look at their operation and ask them, what would you like to improve? How could we make this process better? And then I look at the process with them collaboratively and try to identify where some of the principles, the basic concepts of the Toyota production system may apply to improve the process.
Bonini is in charge of making Toyota's production systems as efficient as possible. New Tech City host Manush Zamarodi decided to explore this notion of 21st century manufacturing efficiency in our world of robots and high-tech sensors. Manush, how was your day with Toyota's Jamie Bonini?
It was kind of weird because I was thinking, John, how could this guy apply these principles, which are really for, you know, a factory line, as you're saying, how can they be applied to a human being who's trying to have creative thoughts? And it was kind of strange going throughout my day. He watched me sort of set up my computer at my desk, and I went down to get my oatmeal at the coffee shop downstairs, and he kind of followed me with his notebook writing down notes the whole time. And I have to say, I was very proud. He came to the conclusion that I was pretty efficient in terms of my personal movements, in terms of how I had my desk set up, in terms of how I got my schedule together for the day. But the problem really was about how our team was working. So he figured, you know, I'm not creating a car every 60 seconds like they are at Toyota, but I am creating a podcast every week, and that is my product. And that's where some of the problems were starting to come. My judoka and my muda were slightly off, he assessed.
I love that his suggestion for you was this. Listen.
Do you have post-it notes?
Yep.
It is low-tech. It's low-tech, deep thought. If we can make it manual, simple, easy to modify, easy to change. This board, when we actually get it running, it may go through 25 revisions before you find one that it really clicks. From my experience, at least for me, it's a lot easier and faster to do those iterative cycles to get a board that's really effective by using post-it notes and flip chart paper or whiteboards and dry erase.
And so then he took you over to the board and gave you a little demonstration about how he would do it. Listen.
What we're trying to do is get what's in your head about what's ahead schedule in good shape and what needs attention and make it visual so you can see it and everyone can see it.
Okay.
And by doing that, often we can see problems more clearly. We can collaborate with other people and get more help and then also improve the overall process by taking what is tacit knowledge to making it explicit.
This is a clash between the Japanese and American way of doing things, and you experienced it personally.
It kind of is, because I sort of wanted him to come and tell me, like, this is what you should do. This is going to fix your problem. And actually what his solution was to create these visual boards that you heard him describing right there. But it wasn't just creating them once. This was going to have to be iterated upon dozens of times. He says that Toyota has these visual boards and each one goes through 50 to 100 different iterations. And let's just be clear, John, these are not just whiteboards with lists on them. What they're doing is they are showing the process.
Process and apparently lots of Toyota-style iterations in your future on the podcast there, Manoush. Manoush Zomorodi, host and managing editor of WNYC's New Tech City. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Climate change is all around us, even if global warming seems a bit remote for winter-weary Americans in the eastern U.S. And the consequences are biological, from frogs who can no longer live in the tree canopies of the jungle because of a tiny decline in rainfall, to insects who can't tolerate polar vortex deep freezes. And this year, it's not just the grasshoppers who didn't plan for winter. Richard Primack joins us. He's professor of biology at Boston University, looking at the impact of climate change on plants, birds, and insects in the state of Massachusetts. Welcome, professor.
Hello, John.
So are we seeing a bit of a polar vortex die-off in the state of Massachusetts regarding the insects besides grasshoppers?
Well, the researchers who are studying insects have found that these temperatures are actually so cold that they're causing a significant die-off of a lot of the non-native invasive insects which are attacking our trees.
So that's good for agriculture in the state of Massachusetts, even if it does diminish the biological diversity for a little while.
Well, it's going to have short-term benefits. So this spring, we'll probably have fewer woolly adelgids and we'll have fewer emerald ash borers attacking our trees. So it's going to cause a temporary benefit for many of these tree species. But the problem is that a significant fraction of these insects are going to survive, the ones that are in slightly more protected places, closer to buildings or in a little bit warmer spots away from the cold. And these small fraction of insects will probably be able to start the infestations again later in the spring and the summer and certainly in coming years.
I know everyone wants to know, does this mean fewer mosquitoes?
Well, this year we will probably start having a later mosquito season because mosquitoes are very sensitive to the timing of thawing of bodies of water in swamps or ponds and streams. And because we've had such a cold winter so far, this thawing will probably occur a week or several weeks later. And this means that the start of the mosquito season, instead of maybe being in the middle of May, for example, in Massachusetts, might be late May or even early June.
So just a delay for mosquitoes, not necessarily a diminishing of their populations. Back to the tree borers. It's interesting what you say here. I'm wondering if cold snaps and cold in general has ever been seen as part of the defense mechanism for trees who are always vulnerable to insect infestations.
Well, that's certainly a feature of the temperate forests that we have in New England and across northern United States, that our forests really depend upon the cold weather, the extreme cold weather, knocking back populations of insects in order to defend themselves against attack. And this is a fairly typical year that we're having this year. So the temperatures are slightly below normal in New England, but this really contrasts with the very mild temperatures which we've had over the last several years. 2010, 2012 in particular were very mild winters in New England. And this is probably a factor which has allowed the populations of things like emerald ash borer and woolly adelgid to really increase in abundance and particularly to extend their range northward.
Certainly there's a consensus that humans should do everything they can to mitigate global warming. But I'm wondering if part of this inquiry in Massachusetts is about the other idea, and that is we need to figure about how we're going to survive and adapt to the global warming that's coming. And looking at these kinds of issues, the species die-offs, how we can take advantage of certain aspects of global warming are all to the good, even if it does represent the same sorts of trends that, you know, have been making scientists very, very worried over the last decade.
Well, I think we will have to adapt to a warming climate. And one of the things that we can start consider doing is planting a wider variety of tree species around our neighborhoods rather than just relying on one species. What's a great concern, though, is the fact that we have relatively few trees in our forests, and we've already lost the chestnuts, we've lost the elm trees, and now we may be in danger of losing the hemlocks and the ashes. Every time we lose a major tree species, it makes our forests much more vulnerable to just almost the collapse of the forest, of soil erosion, flash flooding, lack of habitat for a lot of the animal species. So I think we need to be very concerned about this loss of hemlocks and ashes that we're presently experiencing.
So take the positive for this year on the insect front, but definitely take the long view if we're going to survive. Richard, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you very much, John.
Richard Primack is professor of biology at Boston University, investigating the impact of climate change on plants, birds, and insects in Massachusetts. He's the author of Walden Warming, Climate Change Comes to Thoreau's Woods. It was nearly 3,000 years ago when human beings started asking the really big questions. Why are we here? That's the name of this bit of a Philip Glass movie score. It was the fearless Greek philosophers Anaximander and Thales who first wondered about the deep structure of the natural world in non-religious terms. They were the inspiration for our next guest to devote her life to science, the ancient Greeks, and one very modern scientist, the late Carl Sagan. Asking big questions was the mission of Sagan's 1980 PBS series Cosmos, the most watched series in the history of public television. Now Sagan's fearless wife, Anne Druyan, is finally relaunching that series, Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, this Sunday on Fox. Druyan told us that Sagan would find much to like in the new series, even if he would consider that there is much work yet to be done to make the understanding of science a real priority for Americans today.
I think he would be worried about the last 15 years when we've been in a kind of decline scientifically in terms of our willingness to invest in science, in terms of science as something that we valued culturally and that people were aware of. But I totally feel that the pendulum is swinging back our way and that we're ready to look at the cosmos, the universe, nature, and see it as it really is. And so, yeah, I think Carl, if he were alive, he would feel that we were trending in the right direction.
Was the original Cosmos an attempt to initiate a kind of critical mass, a tipping point in the culture regarding science? And if so, what do you think Carl Sagan would think about the impact of that series looking today?
Well, I never speak for Carl, but I can tell you what I feel, and that is that the spreading effect, the kind of propagating impact of Cosmos is truly extraordinary. There are more people today who are watching Cosmos, whether it be, you know, on any kind of electronic device possible. The number of excerpts from Cosmos on YouTube are downright astronomical. The email that I receive from all over the world usually comes from the young. And so in many ways, I think Carl is more loved than he ever was before. I think the impact of the pale blue dot is something that you can see everywhere. And, you know, it was his dream that we were in the process of becoming an intercommunicating organism. And he died before the internet reached the fullness that we have now. And I think that would have been a fulfillment of a dream for him, that there would be a coalescing community of people on Earth who were willing to think long-term, to act in defense of the environment and the tiny pale blue dot. So, you know, he would have been thrilled to be here at this moment, and I think he would feel that our original series had exceeded our wildest expectations in every way. And then this new series, which grows out of it, but which is completely new, is another example of the power of his original vision.
Would you say the mission of the new series is to mobilize those digital tools and social networking channels that he didn't experience directly, but really do make the argument that we are an interconnected organism on this pale blue dot, and that a search for an understanding of science is a collective global enterprise?
I couldn't have said it better myself. I agree with you completely. And, you know, this is the biggest rollout of a television series in history. 175 countries in 45 languages premiering in, you know, just a few twirls of the planet. I mean, when you think of what Fox and National Geographic have done to bring Cosmos to every conceivable part of the world, it makes me feel like we have very powerful allies in this dream, awakening people to the ancient continuity that science reveals, to the vastness of the universe and its grandeur, more beautiful, more inspiring than any story we could make up. You know, if Cosmos should awaken a new community of people who recognize how tiny and fragile our world is and what our responsibilities are to that ancient continuity, I will be truly happy.
So before we go, I do really think that the Cosmos mission and Carl Sagan's mission was about mentoring as much as it was about science. The idea that one person with a persuasive view can put something like science in your blood and you never forget it. And that's, you know, something that he did and something that he inspired others to do. Do you have a mentor that you can talk to us about, someone who inspired you to get involved in science, either a long time ago or not so long ago?
Well, a long time ago, I became interested in the history of science because I was fascinated by the idea of the first people, the Ionian scientists of ancient Greece, the first people who wanted to understand how nature was put together without resorting to the shorthand of God must have wanted it that way or God did it. The idea of really interrogating nature fascinated me. But as for, you know, a mentor, Carl, you know, just, it's amazing when you fall in love with someone who exceeds your wildest dreams to such an extent that you don't have to pretend to yourself anymore about anything to make yourself feel good. It's a great liberation. And if that man happens to be a person for whom it really matters what's true, it changes you. It makes you, you know, less afraid, more committed to what you're doing. And it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me was to spend 20 years working with, loving Carl Sagan, creating a family with him. And that is really, that's the candle burning for me. That's the flame.
Well, you guys knocked it out of the park the first time around with the Cosmos. It sounds like you're getting ready to do it again. Anne, thanks so much.
So good to be talking with you, John.
Andruyan collaborated with her late husband, Carl Sagan, on the original Cosmos series. She's an executive producer, writer, and director on Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, which premieres this Sunday on Fox. To hear the full interview with Anne, go to thetakeaway.org. Revolutions have anthems. The bloody passion of the French Revolution still rings true in La Marseillaise, whatever version you play. In revolutionary Islam, music is its own controversy. The use of music, the playing of instruments, is a source of religious tension going back centuries. Generally speaking, Sufis are into tunes. Traditional sheikhs and imams are not. One consequence of the Iranian Revolution and the Taliban revolutions in Afghanistan was a banning of popular music of any kind. This tension makes the new book Rebel Music, Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture that much more interesting. It's written by Columbia University lecturer Hisham Aidi. He says there is an amazing musical playlist of revolution inspired by Islam despite this long-standing tension. He gave us a tour, beginning with a band called the Kominas. Their origins? Punkistani, Aidi says. Typical of young musicians taking from everywhere to make a new sound.
There's long been this debate, Sufis versus ultra-conservative Muslims, about music. And in the day and the years after 9/11, the argument was made that, you know, one way to spark a reformation in the Muslim world to promote democracy is to back the Sufis. And music came to be seen as an important tool for public diplomacy, as a way to promote a quote-unquote tolerant Islam, liberal Islam, and so on. So the Kominas are three Pakistani-American kids from Boston, raised between Boston and Lahore. They're into punk rock. They're into Qawwali. They're into rap. A lot of people won't get no justice tonight. A lot of people won't get no supper tonight. Just remember to kick it over and praise Jehovah and kick it out, out. And what's fascinating about them is that they appear in the mid-2000s, right? Partly to contest sort of conservative attitude towards music within the American Muslim community. And U.S. policy, and state policy that tries to really instrumentalize Sufism.
You know, the Kaminas, in a sense, have an advantage in that they look back on a lot of history and have the advantage of being able to immerse themselves in tons and tons of musics. You also describe the influential qualities of the North African experience with Muslim music really in the 1940s. Talk about Salim Halali.
Salim Halali is really a remarkable individual, right? So he grows up in eastern Algeria, is born in eastern Algeria, Annaba. He goes to Algiers, and he makes his way as a stowaway on a ship full of cattle to Marseille to pursue a dream of being a flamenco singer, singing Arabic flamenco. So he gets to Paris in 1937. He's part of the World Expo exhibit, and he becomes enormously popular, playing in different cabarets. And then he disappears. You know, you don't really hear much about him. He dies in 2005. And as soon as he dies, there's this enormous interest in his life. The younger generation is very interested in this artist who is seen as a symbol of Andalusian convivencia. He's seen as a symbol of Muslim-Jewish reconciliation. He's seen as someone who can help calm the memory competition and religious tensions that exist in Europe. And his story, this is what's most interesting about him, is that when Vichy came to power in France, the Grand Mosque in Paris, actually issued some certificates to protect North African Jews from Nazi persecution. And one of them was allegedly Salim Halali.
And the movement that you describe is hardly embodied just in him. You've also got Maurice Al-Medioni.
Right. Maurice Medioni was in Algeria when Vichy came to power, right? And he would be taken out of school as Algerian Jews would be stripped of their French citizenship. And then when Operation Torch, when the Americans landed in November 1942, he would encounter all these American GIs, and he became friends with Puerto Rican soldiers who taught him how to sing Spanish songs and how to play the piano and so on. So he was exposed to Latin music. He'd been trained as an Andalusi pianist, playing with his right hand. He says, the Puerto Ricans taught me to play ragtime and you know, Latin rumbas with my left hand. And he creates, you know, this genre that he calls piano oriental or descarga oriental. And he's someone else who toiled as a tailor for decades in Marseille, right? Nobody knew about him. But in the early 2000s, suddenly he enjoys a rebirth. You know, people are rediscovering, you know, who is Maurice Al-Medioni.
Do you think he and Halali's co-optation, acquiring absorption of various musical styles because of their particular history, you know, has a kind of a hip-hop quality to it? It's not so different from what hip-hop groups are doing today with very different musics. I mean, Kool and the Gang, for instance, has an experience of encountering Islam, which ends up in a very famous song that you describe in this book.
Right. The argument that you hear is that Celebration was actually inspired by the Quran. And, you know, I did some research and I found an interview that Ronald Bell, who's the saxophonist for Kool and the Gang, did in the late 70s. And he says, yes, indeed, you know, one morning I was reading the Quran and I was reading a particular passage, a surah, where God creates man, creates Adam, and the angels start to celebrate. And it came to me, you know, that's where I wrote the lyric, come on, celebrate, come on. You would not expect this. This is the song that's played at ball games, at parades. I mean, it's become an anthem, and it's, you know, it's deeply ironic.
One of the great polyglot stories that's in this book is in Latin America. Tell me about Cafu.
I ran into Cafu, also known as Ali Jamal Shabazz, in Sao Paulo. I was on the outskirts of Sao Paulo visiting a mosque, and somebody had told me about a a small hip-hop collective, right?
Shabazz, there's a familiar name.
Exactly. So this hip-hop collective, you have a number of Afro-Brazilians who have embraced Islam and who have adopted the last name Shabazz after Malcolm X. I mean, what they told me is that hip-hop gave us our political education. And what Ali Shabazz tells me, he says, here in Brazil, you know, you look at racial inequality. He says we have dozens of Trayvon Martins here in Brazil every day, and no one talks about it. And he says the people who die young in Brazil are people who don't know their history. So it's a process of historical recovery that they're trying to do through music.
Let's go out on this track called Radical. It's by Desso Dawg. Willkommen in meiner Welt voll Hass und Blut. Ich schreibe Zeit für meine Kinder und das mit Blut. In einer Welt, wo man nicht mehr weiß, was der nächste Tag bringt. Kinder, Seelen, weinen leise, wenn der schwarze Engel singt. Willkommen in meiner Welt voll Hass. Tell me about Desso Dawg.
Desso Dawg is a German hip-hop artist. He started off as a gangster rapper, and then he moved away from gangster hip-hop and became a Salafism, and then he would become a jihadi, right? And he is currently somewhere in Syria. You know, rumors have it that he may be dead. Others say that he's injured. But he represents the kind of extremist rap that European state officials are worried about. And European governments are deciding how to respond to this kind of thing, right? And so I talk about him, Desso Dawg, and his in that track, in this particular track, he's talking about his conversion, how he went from a world of exclusion and violence and street life and hustling and so on to embracing Islam. And so it's a new protest culture that has gone global that is circulating, you know, via the social media and through migration.
Professor Hisham Aidi, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure.
Hisham Aidi, author of Rebel Music, Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture. Revolutionary anthems? Well, you can sing our praises without any controversy at thetakeaway.org or join the conversation on any part of the program by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.